Okay, what I'd like to do this afternoon is look at what the truth in painting meant to Cézanne, and then try and set out what it took for Cézanne to achieve this. Now, what in essence I'll try to argue is that the truth in painting was something Cézanne could only achieve by learning to be sincere about the effects his paintings actually had. Now, this meant accepting that his earlier work, on the left there, was exaggerated, forced, and faked. Now, Cézanne's change of heart, I will suggest, was affected by his friendship with Pissarro, and also by a reorientation of his theoretical understanding of what made art good. But there's a third factor to Cézanne's attainment of artistic maturity. This, I'll try to show, is that he changed his practice from one that was broadly complicit with what we used to be able to call the alienating effects of capitalism on the artist's relationship with his work, with the wider social world, to one that actually resisted these effects. So, in my own slightly elliptical way, I'll be picking up on what Joachim says in the catalogue about work. To begin with, though, the phrase, the truth in painting, which Cézanne famously used in his letter to Bernard of October 1905, much traversed by Derrida. But I'll start instead by asking a simple question. What did Cézanne mean by the phrase? Now, any answer, as the great Cézanne scholar Robert Ratcliffe pointed out in his unpublished PhD of 1960, must take account of the fact that when Cézanne used it, he was paraphrasing, as he often did, a sentence in Stendhal's Histoire de la Peinture en Italie of 1817, a book he admired for over 40 years. Those of you thinking of joining the FBI may just be able to detect it up here. Stendhal uses this phrase in chapter 14, where he says, si le manque de vérité dans le discours empêche le jugement, en peinture, il empêche la sensation. Now, taking into account its context, which is an argument about the dangers of exaggeration, artifice, and insincerity to art, the sentence is, I think, best glossed as follows. The absence of truth from writing prevents the author's values from coming across. If truth is wanting from painting, it prevents the artist from communicating his sensation. Now, of course, sensation is hardly a straightforward term, either in Cézanne or Stendhal, since, as we've already seen, it embraced both the optical sensation that the artist experienced in front of the motif and the feeling that came along with this. But what is clear is that from about 1870, Cézanne's use of sensation was closely consistent with Stendhal's text, which he read by his own account in 1869. In 1870, on the occasion of the rejection of these paintings, or paintings resembling these images, from the Salon, Cézanne told the caricaturist Stock how he dared, j'ose, to paint his own sensation très forte, very strong sensations. The terms daring and strength are also key terms of Stendhal's aesthetic. So it makes sense to see the dramatic chiaroscuro, gestural brushwork, thick impasto in the painting on the left, all as more or less conventional signs, rhetorical signs perhaps, which Cézanne intended to signify his strong sensations, sensation. It's also worth recalling that many years later, Cézanne described the sitter in the painting on the left, Achille Lempereur, as très fort. By the mid-1870s, however, Cézanne's use of the term sensation had changed considerably. Now, again, as Ratcliffe points out, this was in large part a consequence of his arriving at a new understanding of Stendhal's text, which he was rereading for the third time in 1878. Cézanne also admits in the same letter to Zola, as he told him this, that when he had first read the book in 1869, he read it badly. It seems to follow then that when Cézanne told Zola in the same letter again that he considered painting a means of expressing sensation, moyen d'expression de sensation. Sensation meant something like his personal experience of nature, as it does in Stendhal, at least if you read it very carefully, 2 or 3 times. So what changes in the 1870s is that Cézanne becomes attuned to Stendhal's insistence that the artist needs to learn subservience to the motif in order to achieve pictorial truth. Strength and daring, sure enough, are still important, as is another Stendhalian quality, temperament, but they must not be allowed to overwhelm Sensation. What also matters here, though, is that Cézanne took the phrase "a means of expressing Sensation" from Stendhal, which suggests he accepted the writer's claim that truthful art had to be technically honest, adequate to what it was meant to express, and again, not forced, rhetorical, or exaggerated. Now, by these criteria, at any rate, Cézanne's early work plainly was untruthful and faked Sensation, whereas his mature painting of the 1870s show him beginning to paint the truth, since they exhibit a means of expression which is adequate, we'll see more later, to the experience of nature. Cézanne, in other words, did not use paint in the later 1870s to try to express Sensation that he only fantasized, or which the painting could only express rhetorically. He used paint honestly to do what it could, which is to represent Sensation, whose origin was the interface, as Richard has pointed out, between the painter and the motif. Now, of course, Pissarro, as well as Stendhal, was influential on this change in Cézanne's way of working. But Cézanne's ability to get near the truth in painting, I want to say, is also bound up with a number of changes to his practice in the second half of the 1870s. These, I want to suggest, directly affected the way he engaged with painting, considered both as an activity that was meaningful for him personally and as a social activity involving others. To use jargon, a very little, I want to say, his practice became disalienated. Okay, to make this case, I need first of all to establish, or try to establish, how Cézanne's earlier practice was to some extent alienated. Now, one thing is clear, at least about this period, which is that in the 1860s and early 70s, Cézanne publicly vaunted his work as the efflux of a strong and daring temperament. To propagate this mythology, Cézanne adopted a public persona that was as brash and idiosyncratic as his work. But I think it's vital to see that Cézanne didn't act up through mere eccentricity. He had a coherent economic strategy. The very much neglected work of the late Nick Green has shown conclusively that by the 1850s, the price, the exchange value of a work of art in the market mid-century Paris was tagged, bound to the amount of temperament it was seen to exhibit. So the more individual a temperament a work of art demonstrated, the more it was worth, at least in principle. That's how the critics were drawn in by dealers, for instance, to collaborate in this kind of enterprise. Now, Cézanne's stylistic and social idiosyncrasies make some kind of sense. They're risky but potentially lucrative ploys designed to establish the quality of his temperament and the exchange value of his work, perhaps with a view to building a reputation on the futures market. Cézanne, to put it simply, aimed to become the new enfant terrible of the avant-garde, the successor to Delacroix, Courbet, and Manet. So what I'm suggesting is his early works untruthful in the Stendhalian sense, because to a very significant degree he regarded it and also his own creativity as a commodity. Now, one aspect of the alienation his early practice involved is connected with how, as someone hoping to place his work out on the market, Cézanne sometimes, in fact very often, regarded his fellow artists as adversaries. He told Stock, for example, that while Courbet, Manet and Monet, quote, only painted pictures for the salon, he, by contrast, dared and indeed, quote, would have the last laugh. Now, sure, it's possible to exaggerate the seriousness and importance of remarks like this, but it's also worth remembering, tends to get kind of smoothed over, that Impressionism could be a very internecine practice as well as a collaborative one, and that Cézanne plainly did set out to outdo his rivals on his own territory, exactly as though he believed his own successes were threatened by theirs. On the right, Cézanne's possibly envisaged as a riposte to Manet's Olympia there on the left. Now, granting this much, Cézanne did not enjoy what Marx, for instance, describes as a sense of species being produced by cooperative work. Or if we bring this language down to earth, what we might say is that Cézanne, by virtue of competing instead of collaborating a lot of the time, became estranged from the pleasure that work can provide when those engaged in it come together in a mutual enterprise, a mutually beneficial enterprise. Now, as regards the effects of alienation on Cézanne's experience of the process of painting itself, it would seem that in seeking to make his work stand out in the marketplace, he became estranged from the product of his own labour. Or to put that more simply, his paintings ceased to be fully his. I think one thing that happened here is that the creativity embodied in his work turned for him into a kind of thing that existed beyond him or his control in the marketplace. It became a kind of something he had to parade in public in conformity with what at least he imagined was expected of him. And in this way, the job of painting starts to loom for the artist as something alien to him, something even hostile to him, something whose demands are set by others and by impersonal forces. That's one way, at least, I think, of explaining why Cézanne's earlier work is not simply, as in this case, dreadful, but something he felt he actually had to go back to and redo to make reparation for. Now, there is evidence of a sort, I've been criticised for calling this evidence, anyway, evidence of a sort that this kind of estrangement did occur in a bizarre novel published in 1878 by a friend of Cézanne's called Marius Roux, called La Proie et l'Ombre. And now here in this, the central character, Germain Rombert, who's very closely based on the Cézanne whom Roux knew intimately in the 60s, finds that his relationship with his own work becomes completely blocked when he tries to produce a saleable commodity in the form of a chic genre painting. Previously, Roux tells us, Germain's temperament always pushed him too far for his paintings to have a commercial value, unquote. So when Germain attempts to concoct a chic painting, he finds it adverse to his temperament and strength, and he can't shake off the impression that his strength produces in him. So the canvas, the compromise he tries to produce, comes out all wrong. Now, I think something like this is visible in this painting, which is a strange painting, I think produced over many years, which strikes me as a kind of failed compromise between a commercially viable genre painting, and I'll show you one in shortly that Cézanne actually sold, and a real or truthful Cézanne. Now, in the later 1870s, many things changed. Notably, Cézanne came to enjoy a very different relationship with painting. And for one thing, he came to own and enjoy the process of painting more fully, and consequently to relate to it as a means of discovering his relationship with the world. Cézanne also developed a practice that gave his work public significance, so that he came again to enjoy making paintings because other people benefited from them in a variety of ways. Now, to make this case, I just need to sketch out a few of the facts pertaining to his practice in the late 1870s, and I promise you we'll get to explain Paul Dexon pretty soon. In the first place, Cézanne works closely with Pissarro, who not only shares technical and theoretical information with him, but undertakes Cézanne's education in radical politics, encouraging him to read journals such as La Religion Laïque, excruciatingly boring, I promise you, and Henri Rochefort's La Lanterne de Marseille, which is a kind of incomprehensible kind of ragbag of left-wing gossip. Now, probably as a consequence of this education, Cézanne also buys the illustrated serialization of Zola's novel L'Assommoir from someone whom he describes as the democratic bookseller Lambert in Marseille. Undoubtedly in the belief that Zola's novel was an attack on the exploitation of the urban working classes. Somewhere on that page, I think, is the earliest use of the word modernist. Anyway, that's incidental. Around 1877, Cézanne also joins a circle of bohemian Parisian artists, writers, and musicians, whose stomping ground was the area composed by the north of the Batignolles and the south of Montmartre. For instance, he attends regular meetings at the café, the Ramor, in the Rue Pigalle, where he mixed with Pissarro and the new wave impressionists, very important characters, forgotten generally, Frédéric Corday, Franck Lamy, and Norbert Gunut. And of course, the socialist impressionist musician, of whom we're in a moment, Cabanel. Now, I'll show you an account of the venue published in 1880, which mentions Cézanne on the left there, and on the right, Renoir's painting of his studio in the Rue Saint-Georges we saw earlier on, the right way around this time, which places Pissarro, Cabanel, and Corday nearest the viewer. Cabanel is the guy who looks like he's dying from TB. That's because he is. The same group also attended the salon organized by Nina de Villar in her apartments. She was a strange character. She was separated from her husband, very much an outcast. And Franck Lamy did this picture, was her lover at the time. Now, she, amongst other things, provided meals for artistic ratés, for failures. The rule was you could come to her dinners if you brought a raté along with you. So in her own little way, she's helping people, giving them something to eat. Now, Cézanne himself is represented in the description of Nina's gatherings in the novel Madame Murillo by the ex-war writer, Cézanne's friend, Paul Alexis, in which he's described as Paul Dex, Paul from Hex. He's described as, quote, a sort of awkward, bald colossus, a superannuated child, naive, inspired, at once violent and timid, the only one who really understood Cabanel. Alexi then goes on to describe how Poldex admires Cézanne admires Cabanel's plans for a great realist opera, and how he listens enthusiastically while Cabanel performs his bizarre and incomprehensible musical interpretation of the opening scene of L'Assommoir, in which the workers descend from the outer boulevards into Paris. Just to close the loop, I'm showing you an illustration by Gunut to the edition that Cézanne bought. Okay, it's safe to say then, there's a lot more could be said, but not in this time frame, that Cézanne belonged to a community of like-minded, radical, and I'm going to call them bohemians. In virtue of this, he had people who appreciated his work around him. And moreover, he was sympathetic to their efforts, to their sort of radical politics, which they not only professed, but attempted to live out. Now, Pissarro, for example, famously aspired to work around, quote, big capitalist dealers whom he despised, even if, for one reason or other, he didn't always succeed. In 1880, Alexi, third from the left, gave up a job on the newspaper Gil Blas to write on the anarchist newspaper Le Cri du Peuple. And Cabanel, on the right there, at different times slept rough in restaurants, gave away the large sum of dirty money that he inherited from his parents, who had owned a brothel in Perpignan, and took in homeless writers and artists, including Rimbaud, whom he taught to play the piano. Now, my point is that Cézanne's community was composed of people who made it possible for each other to make a living of sorts from their work, or at least to make it possible for each other to sustain some kind of artistic practice. They were bohemians, in the sense perhaps defined by Tim back in 73, and more especially in the sense to which the original Buvardot from La Vie de Bohème subscribed. People who gave their labour to the wider community to which they belonged. Now, Cézanne gave to his friends no less than they did to him and to one another. In 1881, he helped organise an auction of works donated by fellow artists for the benefit of by then terminally ill Cabanel. Cézanne also tried to help Cabanel exhibit a painting belonging to him at the Salon of 1879, presumably with a view to raising money. And I very strongly suspect this is the Barnes Bathers, which I'll come to very shortly. Now, here's a little bit of a problem. Cézanne, of course, was lucky he could do this because he had an allowance from his father. Up till 1878, this was rather meagre in the region of 200 francs, which is not much. But after 1878, he had a legal settlement was made with his father. We don't know how much, presumably enough to get by. But it does seem that it was insufficient for him to carry on both his practice as a painter and to raise a family at the same time, for the rather simple reason is he ran up enormous debts, of which more in a minute. Now, this meant Cézanne had to try to make money. And one of the few paintings he actually sold in the 1870s was this innocuous genre painting, The Fishing Party of around 1873-4, which was bought by Père Martin. Martin was no big capitalist dealer. Rather, he was a small-scale operator with a genuine interest in modern art, who only took a very modest profit from paintings he actually succeeded in selling, paintings by people like Cézanne, and more especially Pissarro. Now, Martin, it's pretty sure, was the model for Père Malgras, which is to say the kind of shabby art dealer in Zola's L'Oeuvre, who acquires a painting from the Cézanne character from Claude Lantier in exchange for a lobster. And it's certainly not inconceivable that Cézanne made similar deals. The beauty of buying something for a lobster is lobsters don't have a fixed price. You never know the price of lobster. You just know it's too expensive. Anyway, at this time, of course, Cézanne also exchanged rather than sold his work for materials as part of an arrangement he had with the former communard, Julien Père Tanguy. Crucially, it was only when he inherited in 1866 from his father that Cézanne managed to put his relationship with Tanguy on a regular financial footing, when he settled a debt well in excess of 2,000 francs. Now, the point is that this was actually an enormous sum for a colour merchant who would sometimes spend a whole day walking from Paris to Auvers to sell one painting to a collector for 30 francs. So again, like Martin, Tanguy genuinely supported the bohemian community to which he belonged. And what I'm getting at is that Cézanne and his friends really did manage to a very considerable extent to develop a set of economic practices that were marginal to mainstream capitalism, and which in many ways made theirs a discrete economic community, what we might call a subculture. Now, these practices allowed Cézanne to enjoy, there's a lot of pleasure in this, to enjoy, you know, the point of disalienation is it's nice. Allowed Cézanne to enjoy the cognitive and social dimensions of painting far more than previously, brought him closer, that is, to the truth in painting. Now, the story goes that one day in 1877, Cézanne met Cabanel in the street, who admired the bathers at rest in the barns on the right there of 1877, the same year, which Cézanne was carrying with him. And pleased and flattered by Cabanel's response, Cézanne gave him the painting, and Cabanel took it home and hung it above his bed. Well, it sounds like a silly story, but the beauty of this arrangement for Cézanne is that gifting it to Cabert, not selling it for money, but gifting it to him, made his labour into something that brought him a social benefit. By having his work valorised by someone else's appreciation, Cézanne could relate to his own work now as something that really was meaningful and useful, the opposite of a commodity. Now, it was also absolutely appropriate that Cézanne gave this painting to Cabanel, since in many ways it exemplifies the kind of attitudes towards living and work shared by the bohemian group to which he belonged. It represents a phenomenology of time, in which time is qualitative, variable, and flowing, which is to say that the bathers live or experience time naturally. Theirs is the diametric opposite of the mechanical time of the clock that subjects the industrial worker to the inexorable, unchanging, and inhuman rhythm of alienated labour. So here, while the supine figure at the front is already asleep, the figure behind him is stretching, either because he's falling into sleep or waking. Over on the right, the spinario figure, the figure with his foot up, looks on absently, while the central figure seems locked inside that moment where his foot just breaks the surface of the water. Now, that's to say then that time here has a unique pace and a unique character for each figure, even though, of course, they're all together in the same time and the same place. We might say that the painting is a kind of protest against mechanized labor. More importantly, though, I think it's not just the content, it's also the technique. The very awkwardness and improvisation of Cézanne's technique arguably amounts to a repudiation of the kind of mechanical efficiency to be found in academic painting. But it also exemplifies something that Cézanne lived out in his daily life through maintaining or attempting to maintain a flexible and economic practice, flexible and impromptu practice as an artist, both as an economic and social being. The painting, like his life, was something he made up as he went along, a bit like this paper, and took as it came as best he could. Now, for another reason, the painting's awkwardness, another reason for the painting's awkwardness is that Cézanne preferred what he later described as coarse materials. In the later 1870s, he obtained these in the main from Tanguy, who ground his own colours, and not always very well. Now, Cézanne, in other words, deliberately committed himself to using paints that required effort to make them yield or to behave as a medium. By doing this, however, he made his work pleasurable, since I think it took his painting back to what you might call its primitive condition. What I mean is that working with resistant materials gives the painter an enhanced sense of overcoming the otherness of the world, something that's fundamental to enjoying the enjoyment of work, for Marx and for Hegel too. Handling the stuff was a pleasure, which was certainly not to be had from painting with high-grade, extra-fine, almost immaterial materials, such as the paints of Sennelier and Lefranc et Bourgeois, beloved of Bouguereau. Now, Cézanne's pleasure, I better point this out. Whoa, no, done. That's very naughty. Right. Okay. The detail is that apple, the area to the left of that apple. Cézanne's pleasure in engaging with matière is bound up with the pleasure in colour, his pleasure in colour, which of course for him was also the bearer of form. And this absolutely remarkable still life in Winterthur, colour assumes a relatively dark, roughly modulated density that rubs off on the things it represents. As Paul Alexis said in 1886 of a Cézanne still life that he owned, colour like this produces, quote, solid painting, a little dark as in Courbet, but solid. Here too, though, Cézanne paints, to use his own words, en pleine pâte. Can't translate that. Nice and thick. And in the supposedly neutral background of the wallpaper near the apple at the top of the table, Cézanne has used many layers of viscous paint to produce a muted but sensuously rich harmony that enhances the colour and hence the shape of the objects that protrude in front of it. Apologies. I mean, I shouldn't extemporize, but it's utterly astonishing how we get this range of colors from something like beige to something like a purplish blue, and in the middle, a fantastic range of intermediate colors which simply have no name. You couldn't ever name them. It's about the painting very, very dense. Okay, in The Bathers, the effect of this kind of coarsely modulated colour is to give a peculiar solidity or density to the world, or to restore the primitive substantiality that things, especially natural things, have when seen as use values instead of exchange values. Now, the land, for example, in this painting is experienced as something lived in, a material environment which is there in order to be felt through and for the body. The smooth, semicircular arc of blue water at the bottom is cool and refreshing for the bather venturing into it. And by contrast, the sharp triangle of bright yellow sunshine is warm and balmy for the body that it bathes. And I wonder if Kandinsky saw this. Now, the land in this painting is thus the opposite of what it becomes when it's regarded as a commodity or something to be exploited to make cash. Land is seen this way, for example, as a kind of phantasmagoria, if you like, at the end of Zola's L'Oeuvre, where the deceased Claude Lantier is interred in a burial plot which is rented out only for the 5 years that it takes for his body to rot down into bones that can be removed to the ossuary. Now, lastly, Cézanne's people, as well as the land, are rendered dense by his colour and matière, his work. Unlike Bouguereau's nudes, I think it's fair to say, they're solid. Now, in 1877, Frédéric Corday called the bathers Greeks of the Golden Age, perhaps alluding to how the heroes of old were reputedly as big and as heavy as gods. In the Argonautica by Apollonius, for example, Hercules is so heavy that when he steps onto the Argo, its prow tips right up out of the water. Okay. Well, that's a kind of sketch that Cézanne found his way to the truth in painting, partly by developing a disalienated practice. Now, if so, let's say, that's all very well and good. But it is nevertheless important to acknowledge there are many contradictions in Cézanne's practice, some of which could be regarded as contaminating his work. Most obviously, he was only able to sustain his bohemian existence because he took money from his father, who owned a bank. But I think if we're being even-handed, it's equally important to acknowledge that Cézanne arrived at a practice that was disalienated for him through becoming involved in economic and social relationships that were relatively virtuous in their impact on his wider social community, certainly by the standards of the time. I think Cézanne did the best he could, given the circumstances. So to that extent, at least, what Cézanne demonstrates, if you like, is that the truth in painting is one and the same thing as the truth in work. Thank you.